following program is sponsored. The opinions and statements made by the hosts and guests do not necessarily reflect the views of WBOB or its parent company, the Chesapeake Portsmouth Broadcasting Corporation.
Sam Nunberg on the line. Sam, a longtime political associate and operative of Donald J. Trump. He's now with the growing Steve Bannon Political Action Committee, Citizens for the Republic. And Bannon's got like 25 people, and this thing has got polling going all over the place. He's involved in key districts. And Sam is joining us now. Sam, great to have you.
Having me, John. Wow. So you're very optimistic. You think Republicans are going to hold all the seats in Virginia, that sounds like.
Yeah, I think Scott's going to win. I think there's any doubt. The Christopher Newport University poll that came out today has him up by 7, and that poll always is biased the other way. And I think Dave is going to win by a tiny amount, and I know Barbara's going to win. So, yeah, I'm pretty optimistic. I also wanted to thank Sam Nunberg for sending me a text last night, talking me off the ledge after the Astros got beat by Boston. Say, hey, go to bed. They're going to win this series. So I thank you for that, Sam. You know, it's
good. I don't know why you're upset. They did what they had to do the first game. That's all they had to do was get one of those games. It's just not going to. If they get one, all they had to do was win one in Boston. I suspect they'll win the next two, but what do I know? I thought that the Yankees were going to beat Boston.
Me too.
So, But Houston's a great team. I think the issue is what comes out of the National League. I suspect Milwaukee may. I don't really know if it's an upset, but I think Milwaukee may beat the Dodgers.
Well, I think they are also. So we're in agreement with that. But you know what? See, the problem with being an Astro fan is you're paranoid, right? Because we were losers for so long that even though we did win the championship last season, there's just my whole family is paranoid. So we'll see how it goes, but I appreciate that text, Sam, and walking me off that ledge.
Well, I think I heard you before, and I wanted to get to this point. You made a great point about these national congressional polls being released. There is no way in hell, I would say, pardon my French, there is no way that this ABC Washington Post poll, I had some very choice words I sent to George Stephanopoulos via text and to the Washington Post team yesterday about their poll. That poll, I forget the gentleman's name, but it's conducted by some washed-up old liberal. And to think that this is a 13-point race is outrageous. And that is, you know, I didn't want to listen, John, during the 2016 campaign about fake polls because I didn't want to because I thought, by the way, she was going to win until around the last 5 days or so. I thought that Trump was going to win. But I saw the race and I saw their data, and it seemed to me they were off a point or two nationally, maybe giving Hillary Clinton more of a turnout. But on these polls, I would say right now it is 6.5 and barely 6.5 trending down. If it keeps going the way it's going, I think we're going to be sitting under 6 points nationally, and Republicans will, according to you, John, they'll keep all their seats in Virginia. I'm telling you they're going to keep all 9 House seats in New York. I'm calling you from New York City. I think that we will lose only 1 or 2 in New Jersey. But here's the big surprise is, from what I'm hearing, we could keep all our seats in California but for the Darrell Issa seat, which he's leaving, that he barely won last time.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning that that would be, let's say, between Virginia, California, New York, and New Jersey, Democrats at most have a +4, get 4 seats. If they only get 4 seats out of those 4 states, I don't see how they win the House.
Well, yeah, I mean, no question. Now, let's get to New York holding all the seats, because that's been one of the Democrats' key strategies. They think they're going to do better there. What about the embattled Chris Collins seat in Buffalo?
Chris Collins, the seat, first of all, that district, Erie District, that is Trump country. When I was working for Trump in 2014, I was very much against and maybe even thinking about running for governor. But one of the reasons we thought we had a chance was because of Erie, called the Erie County. They split the district into two because we have Democrats controlling the state on the gerrymandering. We could have had an extra Republican congressman out of there if they didn't gerrymander it. Collins district is very safe. Collins has been known to be rich and not spend his money. He is spending his money to keep the seat. Republicans, what happened in the state of New York was Republicans held a convention for their nominating. It's the first time they've done it, at least since 1950. So they were not able to kick Collins off the ballot. Once he wasn't off the ballot, which I don't think he ever really wanted to leave,
mm-hmm.
Once he wasn't off the ballot, he committed and he put down money. Steve Bannon, I'm just arranging right now, is going to be out there for a full day doing events. We're going to be showing Trump at War. We're renting a humongous theater there,
mm-hmm.
having two separate rallies, and he's going to be appearing legally, of course, John, in the most legal way under FEC guidelines, with the local state reps. And I just want to let your audience know about the Collins district. There is a David DiPietro, who's a state assemblyman, and he is basically Freedom Caucus on steroids. So it is a very conservative district. I mean, Collins himself has been considered too liberal for that district.
Right, right.
And he's typically won the primaries because he's outspent his opponent. So that's one of the reasons he was the first person after endorsing Jeb, he went to endorse Trump during 2016. So we're going to hold that seat. The only seat in New York that you could argue with me we could possibly lose, and I don't think we will, was this New York 19. And just to explain it, I don't know your districts perfectly, but I would say half the district was like Comstock's district.
Right.
But the other half is upstate New York. We have John Sasso, who's the congressman. He's only a one-term congressman, but he's been a New York politician, has high name ID. And the Democrats, in their infinite wisdom, recruited a terrible candidate. So I'm telling you, I think that we're going to hold all the seats.
Remember,
this is about attrition. It's just we need to stop the attrition.
Right.
We just need to keep what we have.
Sam, what about the Staten Island seat?
Staten Island, first of all, Staten Island is the most conservative district in the borough of New York.
Right.
In 2006, but there were a couple issues that happened. Our congressman, I forget his name, it came out that he was living in Virginia and he had two families. So everybody realizing, including Republicans, that George W. Bush,
yeah,
I'm saying this, not you, was probably the worst president in modern day history.
No, we're in total agreement with that. Total agreement.
Okay. So, but with that said, that was a fluke.
Right.
On the other hand, they recruited. What happened is the Democrats recruited a vet. You know the whole deal. They recruit
right.
these people. You think they're Trump candidates.
Right.
And he has a lot of money. But Steve Bannon's going to be there. I've spoken to their general consultant. And essentially, after a contested primary with a Michael Grimm,
right.
they have themselves up in singles. But trending their way, they just have to get the Trump vote out. I suspect we're going to hold that district. That's not the district that worries me. Once again, the district to watch is New York 19, the John Sasso against, I forget who the gentleman is, just because it's suburban.
Right.
It's, majority Democrat in terms of Democrat advantage. But it's still an R+2 district.
We're with Sam Nunberg, a longtime political operative of Donald J. Trump. He was also with the Trump campaign. He's now with Steve Bannon's new political action committee. He's a senior advisor there, Citizens for the Republic. Sam, let's go to New Jersey. I'm from New Jersey. I've still got friends there telling me that this guy running for Senate, the Republican Bob Hougan, has a fighting chance to knock off Menendez in an upset. Now, I've been in New Jersey. I grew up in New Jersey. Like, I just don't ever buy any of this stuff. The Republicans always get close and then lose. Is that real? Can Menendez lose?
I would agree with you on that. I don't want to be pessimistic and hurt depression. I would just say to all of New Jersey, please vote, because you need to vote in your House races to keep those House seats for President Trump. It's always an uphill battle to beat Menendez. He raises a lot of money, but, yeah. I mean, he's going to win by a smaller amount, I would say.
Right, that's kind of
But he's still going to be the senator.
All right, let's get Sam to these fake polls. So you look at the polling that's coming out showing this, you know, these wide gaps by Democrats, and they're using the same polling methodology they did in 2016 when all of them kept saying
even worse, by the way.
Worse,
I would argue, John. Sorry to interrupt you, but even worse.
Worse. So they're fake polls by the fake news, driving a fake agenda for a fake narrative. I mean, do they ever learn, or is it just trying to depress Republican and turnout?
Well, yes, I think first off that despite what they will tell you, they certainly are trying to depress Republican turnout. I think that you talk to, look, I have friends in the New York Times, the Washington Post, those reporters as well, they all talk, or at MSNBC contributors, and they all talk as if it's, you know, fait accompli that we'll be going through impeachment proceedings because the Democrats are going to win. I do agree with them, by the way. If the Democrats get the House, they will look to impeach President Trump, but it fits their narrative. They're not sophisticated. It's older. These are older pollsters. They don't understand the demographics. What I also think too is the following: the reason I said that they were worse when you were talking about it, John, is because they are basing it on a voting model. Let's say the ABC Washington Post. That's typically the worst of the worst. Okay,
right.
It's the equivalent of, let's say, the worst liberal you can think of that just thinks, you know, Democrats are always right and Republicans are always wrong by it. They base it on a model where they're looking at people that typically don't vote, frankly, aren't even registered sometimes. Voting this time. And they base it on the fact of the Women's March, on this, on that. Let me tell you something. Millennials aren't coming out to vote the way these Democrat pollsters are putting it in. Millennials are not coming out to vote for Democrat candidates. That's one issue. The second issue is, unless you show me a poll and I would tell you, here are two real polls, John. I look at the CBS YouGov poll. With that pollster, I forget his name, he released the book. And he says, look, I'm giving it to you three ways here. Best case scenario right now for the Democrats under my polling, he had the Democrats with a 10-seat majority. Worst case scenario under my polling, he only has the Democrats, and he has the Republicans keeping the House by one seat. I still think that under national circumstances, the reason he says that is because what they do is they do their generic that way. And remember, doing these congressional races, the way they do it for congressional as opposed to these Senate races, it's just not a fair or accurate way to do it because of the gerrymandering, the way these districts are, the way they poll people, let's say in the state of California, the state of New York, or even the state of Virginia. And then they put that into their poll as a composite. It's just not accurate. It doesn't represent the way they don't weigh it accurately for what it has to come out to flip Republican seats to Democrats. Part of it. So what I want to also say is part of it is just simple laziness by them, laziness or unsophisticated ways of doing it. And part of it is that it's very expensive. Look, it is expensive if you wanted to do what we did. Citizens of the American Republic, Steve Bannon's group, we spent $200,000 on polling. And what we did was we sub-regioned the polling in the states as well. We didn't even do state. We said we want to see, let's say, Upper West New York, mm-hmm. right? We want to see Southwest California. We want to see mid. We want to see. We will look at the state of Washington, right, where we have a Washington A. We said we want to see the northern western column of Washington.
Right.
That's the way you got to do it. But that, look, that was $200,000 we spent.
Right.
You know.
So it's a lot more expensive to do it the right way than do it the
Yeah, but what's ironic is these networks, they don't spend the money they have to spend, but they have 15 people doing jobs that one person can do.
Right.
Right? In some of these newsrooms and things like that, you would think they actually would want to spend money on real polling, but they don't.
All right, let me shift over to some policy, and I want to get your thoughts. Mike Pompeo just dispatched to Saudi Arabia to Riyadh by the president, who spoke with Mohammed bin Salman, King Salman, today. King Salman denying he had anything to do with Khashoggi. That's hard to believe for the average person, but he is denying it. You have to, I guess, take that. But then the president turning around and telling Pompeo to go there, the president saying on Saturday that he was, that if it was proven that Khashoggi was murdered in the consulate, that there would be severe punishment for the Saudis. The Saudis then turned around under MBS and said, we will retaliate. What do you make this whole thing, Sam?
Well, I think retaliating, that's ridiculous. The retaliating comment coming from Saudi Arabia was on their state-run TV. It was probably someone the equivalent of like a radio host saying something, right? So let's not take that. And there's no way the Saudis, they said they'll retaliate and they'll start aligning themselves with Russia. You want to align yourselves with Russia. You'll end up in the Shia, the Iranian crescent. So that's not realistic. What I think is the following. This reporter was killed by the Saudi Arabians. Not only was he killed, he was apparently killed in a barbaric manner. It was something that went wrong. I don't know why this gentleman went into that consulate. That was obviously he's not responsible at all for what happened, but considering what considering the pieces he was writing and knowing about MBS. Look, MBS, Donald Trump is correct about MBS for the following reason. Remember, George W. Bush took us into Iraq. Not only, fine, you want to remove Saddam, but then he said, we're going to have them vote and they're going to select a democracy and you're going to end up having Starbucks there and movie theaters. Okay, that's not the way it worked out. Mm-hmm. I have no problem with us in these regions supporting monsters if there are monsters. But if they are our monsters, they need to realize that they can act like monsters in their own fiefdoms. We're not going to judge them on that, but you can't do that to Americans.
Right.
This man is an American citizen. He's an American resident. I don't think that the munitions should go to Saudi Arabia.
Agreed.
There has to be some kind of consequences for this. And I will say, from a selfish point of view, one, the president has done the right thing by sending Pompeo there. Number two, we can't let this be the Democrats' October surprise. I'm going to just tell you from the election. It may not be nice to say that. It is what it is. I say things. I'm not politically correct. So I just think we need to handle it. I also agree, though, we need that. There is no reason why we should not sell them arms that can be used against Iranians and or Iranian proxies. Otherwise, the Chinese will sell them to them. So that's what that's where we are. And I think the president just needs to handle this. If I were MBS, I would stop issuing these denials because, another piece of news to me was they have everything from the man's Apple Watch, right? So now, I mean, I wear an Apple Watch. Now we know that even when you wear your Apple Watches, the government, we're talking about Turkey, can get all your audio. So MBS clearly, from all public reporting, murdered this guy. I don't care if this journalist was Muslim Brotherhood. I don't care who his allies were. I don't care what he didn't meet with bin Laden. It's irrelevant,
right?
And he cannot conduct himself. If he wants to be a Western deciding he wants Saudi Arabia to modernize. And frankly, MBS wants Saudi Arabia to modernize economically, John, so he can stay in power. The same way that Trump is trying to make a deal with Kim Jong-un. Kim Jong-un will give up nukes if Kim Jong-un can stay in power, right?
Right.
So I think that there has to be some consequences for this. And the president, I think, will announce them soon.
Sam, we're in complete agreement. Great analysis. Thanks for being with us, Sam Nunberg. Always appreciate it. Sam, with Steve Bannon's Political Action Committee, Citizens for the American Republic, CARS, the acronym, Citizens for the American Public. You can find it on the web. Sam, thanks for being with us. Joining us now, Seb Gorka. He was a senior advisor to President Trump in the White House. He was also a very senior member of the campaign, and he's now the author of a new must-read book, Why We Fight, Defeating America's Enemies with No Apologies. In fact, he's got a book party tonight. Okay, Seb, great to have you back here on the John Fredericks Radio Network.
Great to be back with Godzilla.
Thank you, Seb. Let's get to the Saudi Arabian situation, Seb. Not too good. First, they say, Jamal came out. Then they say he didn't come out. It's like the Roach Motel. You go into the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, but you don't come out. Now they say, well, maybe it was rogue murder that he went in for interrogation, but there's no official statement coming from King Salman, who denies the whole thing. And now the Saudis threatening that there's any sanctions, they're going to retaliate and disrupt the world's economy and shoot up oil prices. Seb, what the hell is going on here?
Well, this individual, who's not a journalist, he's an opinion piece writer, he's not an American, he was a resident alien. He's been caught up in the middle of a geopolitical competition between two Sunni nations who want to dominate the Sunni Muslim world. That's Turkey, which is becoming a neo-Ottomanist theocracy under Premier Erdogan, and Saudi Arabia, where Islam was founded in the 7th century, and this person has been caught in the middle. An individual who, if the reports are true about what happened to him, didn't deserve what happened to him, but was a very, very shady character with very close ties to the Muslim Brotherhood, even to the Bin Laden family, and an individual who was the nephew of the biggest arms dealer in the 20th century, Khashoggi. So it's basically an individual caught in the middle of a giant geostrategic competition.
So the president's sending Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to Riyadh to try to get to the bottom of this, find out what happened. Obviously, the Saudis, the first statement they put out, which was that this individual was there an hour, got his paperwork and departed. But they said the dog ate the cameras or something. They couldn't produce the footage of that. Now they're changing their story. How does this affect the U.S. relationship with the Saudis as it relates to Mohammed bin Salman?
Well, when we were in the White House, we were very encouraged by the reforms that MBS was initiating. We always used the term behavior modification. Saudi Arabia had been in bed with the wrong people for far too long. Key members of the elite had been funding and supporting jihadi ideologues and jihadi activists around the world. That was going on a very, very positive path. This is not what we expect from a nation that says it's reforming itself. So, you know, Mike Pompeo is a tough guy, top of his class at West Point, former director of the CIA. He will get to the bottom of it. And if the reports turn out to be true about what happened to Khashoggi, there will be consequences for Saudi Arabia, definitely of arms and trade, is my expectation.
Do you think that this might affect the United States backing of the Saudi Emirates coalition in the Yemeni civil war, Seb?
So the big muscle movement right now in the region is at the beginning of the administration, the GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council, turned its back on Qatar, which is the worst offender in the region when it comes to sponsoring radical Islamic groups. That's going to be the primary concern, that we maintain pressure on Qatar and the GCC continues to behave in ways that lessen the impact or the importance of these radical groups. On top of that, there's the second and the tertiary order effects, most important of all being Iran. So, you know, there is a balance in the region.
Radio, AM 600, 101.1 FM, WBOB.
With SRN News, I'm Val Dior. U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton will face 2 days of high-tension talks in Moscow starting Monday after President Trump announced he'll withdraw from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, or INF, pact. Meanwhile, President Trump will be in Houston on Monday campaigning for Republicans for the midterms, in Wisconsin on Wednesday, and Charlotte, North Carolina on Friday. The death of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi and his country's claim that it happened during a brawl inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul continues to roil the international community. The EU says the emerging details are deeply troubling and that a thorough, credible, and transparent investigation is needed. About 30 hospitalized after a floor collapsed during a party at a condo clubhouse near Clemson University. Dozens tumbled into the basement while partygoers were jumping to a popular song. This is SRN News.
Are you putting your retirement savings in a 401k, IRA, or investment account? Then I have one word of advice. Stop. Many experts warn of a stock market crash any day now. And if it's anything like the last two crashes, you could lose 50% or more of your hard-earned savings in the Wall Street casino. Can you afford to lose half of your retirement savings again? Hey, you don't have to lose a penny, because there's a better, safer way to save for retirement. And you can learn all about it in a free report. This is the report Wall Street and big banks desperately hope you never see. Why? Because this method continues to grow your money even when the market tumbles. It lets you take back control of your money and finances, and it gives you penalty-free access to your savings. Plus, it beats the pants off any 401k or IRA. These are uncertain times, so get the information you need today to guarantee your retirement security. To get this free report, go to bankonyourself.com right now. That's bankonyourself.com. bankonyourself.com.
Attention all men. Have Viagra and Cialis let you down? Think your best days are behind you? Think again. If you suffer from any type of ED, regardless of your age or medical history, the doctors at Alpha Medical Group can help you now. There is no needles, no surgery, and no medication. Just the newest available proven treatment from Europe using acoustic energy waves. Our FDA-cleared medical device regenerates blood vessels and erectile tissue with short in-office sessions. And it's all done with virtually no needles, no surgery, and no medication. Call now for full information. Call 904-763-1400. That's 904-763-1400. 100% natural, non-invasive way to fix erectile dysfunction. Call 904-763-1400 today and get your life back with Alpha Medical Group. Call 904-763-1400 or visit our website at alphamedicalgroup.com.
Leave the summertime cooking to the Original Tunis Restaurant, 7400 103rd Street, just west of 295. Dine in, drive through, or use Uber Eats. The Original Kronos Gyros, shrimp, fish, oysters, wings, and more. The Original Tunis can cater any occasion. 317-9300. And talk with Z, the owner and founder. Ask him how your church or civic group can use the Original Tunis Restaurant for your next fundraiser. The Original Tunis Restaurant, 7400 103rd Street, open 7 days a week. Come meet Z, the founder.
The latest traffic and weather on WBOB, your 2018 election authority.
Joining us now, Senator Tim Kaine, Virginia Democrat, ran for vice president, as you know, with Hillary Clinton 2016. He's up for re-election for a second term. Senator, great to have you with us.
Yeah, John, good to be with you today.
Boy, we got a lot to go over. Let's start with Jamal Khashoggi. This is very troubling to a lot of people. It's like the Roach Motel. He went in, but he didn't come out. Now, there's a lot of allegations from the Turk saying that he was murdered, chopped up, some even saying that he was chopped up and put into bags while still alive. Just a horrific situation and a disruption to the international community, because when you go into, as you know, Senator, an embassy or a consulate, that's supposed to be a safe haven. I know Secretary Pompeo was there. The president wants to wait till all the facts come out. Share with us your perspective on this as it is now.
Well, John, yeah, you're right. Really troubling. I'm a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I am the lead Democrat on the subcommittee that oversees the U.S.-Saudi relationship, and this has the potential to dramatically change the relationship between our countries. You're right that, the murder of a journalist has to be taken seriously. This is a journalist who was living in Northern Virginia, right near Tyson's Corner in Fairfax, writing for the Washington Post. And B, the murder of anybody at a consulate, which should be a safe haven, that would take place is shocking. So there's a couple of things that we're doing in Congress about it. First, on the Foreign Relations Committee, we sent a letter to the president that would trigger the Magnitsky Act. I think you know that Magnitsky Act was named after a Russian dissident who was murdered by the Russians for his political activity. Congress sends a letter to the president that gives the president 120 days to make a ruling about whether the murder is a human rights violation, and if so, what sanctions would be imposed. We sent that letter about 2 weeks ago. The other two issues that are currently under consideration that are somewhat related are whether they should stop or put a moratorium on arms sales to the Saudis. We have significant arms sales to them, and they have for years. And third, and this is one that I'm very focused on because it was a significant passion of Jamal Khashoggi's, is whether the United States should stop supporting any Saudi efforts in the war in Yemen, the civil war in Yemen that's going on between a Houthi minority and the Yemeni government. And Saudi Arabia is very, very involved in favor of the government against the Houthis in that war. The United States is providing support for the Saudis in that position, refueling aircraft and others. And we have had some votes to try to stop U.S. participation in that war. We had one recently that got up to 47 votes in the Senate, not 50, not 60, but pretty significant vote total. And I am increasingly of the opinion that the war is a humanitarian disaster and the United States should not be assisting the Saudis in the prosecution of that war. But we're going to, you know, get more facts. But bluntly, I think the burden is on the Saudis to prove that they had nothing to do with any harm, kidnapping, or murder of this journalist. Enough facts are out there, enough information and corroboration is out there that the burden is now on their shoulders. They're going to have to prove that they weren't involved in any harm. And if they don't, I think it's going to fundamentally change the relationship we have with the country of Saudi Arabia.
Senator Kaine, is this now the day of reckoning for the U.S. relations with the Saudis?
I believe it is. You know, John, the way you asked that question, I think I know what you're thinking. There have been some very, very significant challenges in the relationship in recent years, beginning with the overwhelming majority of the 9/11 attackers were Saudis.
Yes.
And then you move forward to a whole series of other instances, Yemen, bizarre Saudi behavior in recent years, especially since the ascension of the Crown Prince MBS to his position. As you know, within the last year, the Saudis were involved in a bizarre kind of near kidnapping of the Lebanese Prime Minister Hariri.
Hariri, you're right.
Where they sort of, as he was visiting Saudi Arabia, he gave sort of a forced televised interview announcing his resignation from the position in Lebanon. That was widely viewed as a Saudi power play. And I'll tell you, when I go to the region, what I hear, and I hear it in Lebanon, I hear it in Iraq, I hear it when I talk to Syrians in the region, is that if every other problem in the region were solved, it is still the Saudi-Iranian proxy war that crushes people all around the region. If we solve problems of corruption, if Israel-Palestine made a deal tomorrow and there was a two-state solution and that wasn't an agitator, if there were all kinds of other issues solved. But if Iran and Saudi Arabia continue to engage in war throughout the region would still be in significant turmoil. And so obviously Iranian activity in the region is difficult and causes major problems. Mm-hmm. We have to lean into that. Mm-hmm. But Saudi activity in the region is also I think, responsible for this humanitarian crisis in Yemen, the instability in Lebanon, and other major issues. And so this, I think, has the feeling of a potentially a watershed time in the relationship.
I think you're right. And there's other issues as well. The consolidation of power by MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, arresting all of what you might consider his potential rivals, calling it corruption, putting them in a hotel. The administration looked the other way on that. I kind of got it. Their business, all right. They kind of went with it. But then you've also got the Gulf blockade they did against Qatar, which really made no sense. And it's because it's backfired on them because the nation of Qatar is now better off than they were. So that's backfired and blew up in their face. Now they're trying to put up
a
moat.
John, as you know, Qatar, you know, there's challenges with Qatar, but Qatar is also the home of a major U.S. Air base at the Al Udeid Air Force Base in Qatar. We would not have been able to prosecute the war against ISIS without being able to use that base. I've visited that base on two occasions. And so the aggressive nature of Saudi Arabia toward Qatar, prosecution of this humanitarian disaster by most accounts in Yemen and these other instances. And, you know, I think for a long time, hey, let's be blunt, the basis of the relationship was that the United States needed oil from Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. And that's less and less the case. Mm-hmm. The United States now becomes a net energy exporter as we develop our own energy sources. Our need to rely on oil from Saudi Arabia and turn our head the other direction on human rights issues, on equal status of women, prosecution of political dissidents, etc. We don't have to turn our head any longer.
I think you nailed it. And I tell you what, I don't want this to become, I don't know how we navigate our way through it, but as you know, I'm a non-interventionist and I'm vehemently opposed to our involvement in supporting the Saudi Emirates coalition in forwarding the civil war against the Yemenis, 50,000 people dead. People are starving, children eating bark off trees. I mean, the thing is horrific. We've got school buses getting blown up with bombs made in the USA. I mean, the whole thing is a disaster. We shouldn't be there. Obama got us in. The president, who, as you know, I'm a big supporter of, campaigned to get us out. We're not out. But the other day, this is interesting, and I just want your comment on this. One of the strangest alliances of all time, your colleague Lindsey Graham wants a muscular national response to everything, as you know, part of the neocon set, aligning himself with Rand Paul, the non-interventionalist in getting out of this war, and Rand Paul saying he's going to bring it to a vote on the Senate floor. How would that work, and when would that be?
We are, John, we're out until Veterans Day. We'll be back in the day after Veterans Day. And I think you're going to see a lame duck session like no other. I think it's going to be extremely intense in November and December. There are different ways this can come up for a vote in the Senate. You know, one senator can sort of stop action on virtually anything until you get your way on something else. So I think the two issues you'll see come up, and you are right to point out, when Lindsey Graham, who's an interventionist, says it's time for us to get out, that really tells you something. Rand Paul and I and Chris Murphy and others have been in the position of trying to block arms sales to stop activity in Yemen for a while. But with Lindsey and others coming on board, it does show the change in the relationship. So I think you'll see a floor vote on the Senate on one of two, and maybe both. You may see a floor vote on blocking arms sales, and you may also see a floor vote on stopping any U.S. support for the war in Yemen. We were in Yemen battling ISIS and al-Qaeda. There is an ISIS and al-Qaeda presence in Yemen. But then separate to that, the civil war between the Houthis and the Yemeni government started, and U.S. activity has sort of bled over from the battle against ISIS and al-Qaeda into active participation on behalf of the Saudis in the civil war. And I think it's time that we stop that.
Let's move on. Senator Tim Kaine with us here on the John Fredericks Radio Network, and he's running for election to a second term. That'll be decided on November 6th. His Republican opponent is Prince William County Chairman of the Board of Supervisors, Corey Stewart. Senator, the Honduras-Guatemala caravan, now up to 4,000 people, traveling to the United States. They want to come to the country illegally. These are not refugees for asylum. They're calling themselves economic refugees. Well, Senator, there's 4 billion people around the globe that could be economic refugees that could find a better life in the United States. Are you in favor of just 4,000 or 5,000 people just walking over the border in this caravan and being absorbed into the U.S.? And if we do that, what's to say the next one isn't going to be 40,000 or 50,000?
Yeah, no, you're right, John. Look, we have to have laws about who gets in and who doesn't, and we have to have border security. I have voted for it repeatedly. As you know, I was part of the group in the Senate in June of 2013 that passed a comprehensive immigration reform bill. And in that bill, folks often don't pay attention to this, in that bill, there was $40 billion of border security over 10 years. President Trump is now asking for $25 billion of border security over 10 years, less than we originally included in the bill that we did. We need comprehensive immigration reform. I am not for open borders and never have been. We need to make sure we invest the money in the right way. So I actually worked with Lindsey Graham in February. We put a deal on the table for the president. The deal was, Mr. President, can you take yes for an answer? The deal involved protection for Dreamers, which the president had said Congress should do, and it involved the complete $25 billion that the president had asked for over 10 years with congressional oversight to make sure it was spent right. But the president, when we put the deal out there, trashed it. We had 8 Democrats and 8 Republicans. The president could have accomplished something that he said that he would do when he ran for office, and he chose to attack it because he wants to dramatically change family unification in the diversity visa program, et cetera. But with respect to the caravan, shouldn't be able to just come in. From Honduras, from Denmark, or from anywhere, there have to be rules, and the rules need to be enforced, and that's why it's time that we do the comprehensive immigration reform.
Well, I think the president is open to DACA negotiation. I mean, I think he does realize that these are children in the United States. They know no other place. I think the real negotiating issue now becomes the president is adamantly opposed to the continuation of chain migration, and he would prefer a merit-based economic system of immigration like Canada or Australia has, that basically says if we have a need for pipe fitters and there's pipe fitters in Somalia, they go to the top of the line because if they immigrate to the United States, they're going to find a job. So that's the issue that's going to have to get worked out as you guys go forward with this. But
and John, there may be a discussion. I mean, in the lame duck, I was talking about that earlier, how many issues there are that are out there. We avoided government shutdown, et cetera, by finding an appropriations bill on most of the major categories of government before the end of September. That was good. But the one item where we just did a continuing resolution through early December for continued discussion is in the border funding area. So, yeah, we're going to have between the election and early December, we'll have a major discussion with the president about that. And he wants the border security money, which we've been willing to vote for, and we want reforms as well. We'll get into that discussion in the next month or so.
As this caravan gets through Mexico and gets to the southern border of the United States, Senator Kaine, what should authorities do? What should we do?
Well, first, I mean, let's not wait. The marchers are not to the Guatemalan-Mexican border yet, so we need to work with the governments of Guatemala and Mexico on this. And, you know, I hope that the president's, especially, you know, often tough talk about Mexico, et cetera, does not hurt our ability to reach an accord with Mexico on this. I think one of the issues that's important is you got to have allies in the world. And when you have allies, you can work together on joint solutions. The best thing is for the caravan of people to remain in Honduras or not even get to the border with the United States. But that would involve the U.S. having a cooperative relationship with Mexico, for example, and not spending time trashing Mexico, which the president often does. So I know that the U.S. military, the North Command, which basically is everything north of the Mexican-Guatemalan border, our own, we do have DHS and other U.S. presence in Mexico. I would hope that we would work with the Guatemalan and Mexican governments to have that caravan of folks remain in place. I know the president of Honduras, he always points out, no country wants to export its young. There are also things that we can do to help promote stability in Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. And if we do that, we can reduce people who are leaving those countries to come to the United States.
You know, Senator, you spent time as a young man in missions, in Jesuit missions, and I really respect what you've done and your work in that. And now, what do you think about these violent left-wing mobs that are going around chasing people out of restaurants, spitting on Lindsey Graham, sending packages and horrific emails to Susan Collins? And
no, it's so discouraging, John. It really is. I had an event last night out in Fairfax County where there was sort of a disruptive protester. It was just a happy hour for young Democrats in Fairfax, and a disruptive protester tried to get in my face with the camera and let me hoping, I think, that I would say something intemperate that they could then put on video. And whether it's somebody doing that to me, whether it's somebody sending something to Susan Collins's home, the colleague being accosted in a restaurant, it really, really, I don't know, it's just sickening. And you see, an escalation of all kind of violent behavior. We saw 19 swastikas painted across the front of a Jewish community center in Fairfax two Saturdays ago. That was very shocking. So I think we have to, those of us in elected positions, what we have to do is maybe try to be better role models, bring down the temperature, bring down the rhetoric. You can disagree with somebody without being, you know, intemperate or uncivil to them. I really try hard to do that in everything I do. I disagree with the president on a lot. He signed 17 of my bills, you know, that I've been able to put on his desk. I try not to get into the name-calling thing, but you're right. Any violence has to be condemned, and whether it's violence on the left, on the right, violence that's, you know, not political in nature, has to be condemned. One of the great things about our Constitution, as you know, your favorite part of the Constitution is in the First Amendment, freedom of the press, and my favorite part of the Constitution is in the First Amendment, too, which is the right of the people to peacefully assemble, the right of the people to petition government for redress or grievances. We give citizens the right to peacefully assemble, but it's got to be peaceful, or to, you know, write letters to congressmen, but it's got to be peaceful. And I think that the framers realized that engagement was necessary for a democracy to work, but they understood that the engagement had to be peaceful, and any kind of disruptive or violent activity has to be condemned.
But, Senator, when your former running mate Hillary Clinton said that uncivility is acceptable in this environment, doesn't that add fuel to the fire? I mean, where's the Democratic condemnation of this
stuff? Yeah, I disagree with that sentiment completely. I think you got to maintain civility, especially at the top. Let me use two role models on my side of the aisle. You could think of some role models on your side of the aisle. Nobody would say Bobby Scott is not a very progressive Democrat. Very progressive Democrat, very firm in his point of view. He points out what he thinks is right. He points out what he thinks is wrong. But Bobby Scott has had a political career where nobody thinks of Bobby Scott as an uncivil person or a name caller. Don Beyer would be another example in Virginia, a very progressive Democrat, points out what he thinks is right, doesn't mind calling out something that he thinks is wrong. But he calls Don Beyer a name caller. Nobody thinks he's uncivil. So I think I can look at examples, and look, I've got colleagues on my side. I can think of Senate colleagues on the Republican side, Lamar Alexander. Lamar is my chair of the Health Education Labor Pension Committee. He's very much a Republican, and he's going to say what he thinks, and he's going to point out if he sees something that he thinks is wrong or something that a Democrat wants to do he doesn't like, he'll be plain about it. Nobody says that Lamar Alexander is an uncivil person. So I think I think the rhetoric that's out there that says, you know, well, it's time for a holiday from civility is wrong. No, I think we need it now more than ever.
Well, the example of Bobby Scott's an excellent one. He's my congressman, and he has been right on some of the biggest issues in America in the past two decades. So, yeah, you can call him a progressive,
and John, he and I agree
on a bunch of things.
That even when you disagree with Bobby Scott,
that's great. Yeah,
nobody
great.
Thinks of Bobby Scott as like a name caller or something. That's not who he is.
And we need
to act like that.
I would put your colleague Senator Johnny Isaacson in that category.
Absolutely.
Same thing. Everybody knows where he stands. He's very conservative. He votes with the president 100% of the time, but everything is done in a civil, respectful manner. We're very short on time, but I've got to get to the election because that's coming up in 19 days. You have what looks like to be, Senator, an insurmountable lead in both polling and numbers, but, you know, nothing is certain. The only poll that matters is the one on November 6th. Tell me about your reelection campaign, what you've seen, how it's going, and what you think the outcome will be.
Well, as you point out, John, 19 days, and yeah, polls are looking pretty good, but I always tell people, polls are about preferences and elections are about energy, and preferences isn't the same as energy. So what you want to see is energy. I've loved serving in the Senate. My campaign theme that I chose is I'm trying to reflect the way I've lived and the way I've served in Virginia that works for all. It's about Virginia. It's about work and the centrality of work and honoring work and having good policies about work and the workforce. But it's also about this Virginia that works for all. I've been kind of obsessed with the last two words in the Pledge of Allegiance, the notion that, you know, if it's not working for all, it's not working. If it's not working for all, we have more work to do. So I'm going to continue, should I be elected, I'd be honored to be reelected. I'm going to continue to work on these areas, armed services, foreign relations, budget, and then health, education, labor, pension. I have seen really during this calendar year, 2018, maybe no surprise given the elections, the results in last November's elections in Virginia, I continue to see very strong energy, turnout at events, mm-hmm. voter registration for a midterm year. We're seeing pretty strong energy in early vote that's taking place. But as you point out, nothing for granted. To go back and quote Bobby Scott, he says there's only two ways to run an election, either run unopposed or run scared. I'm opposed, so I'm running scared. So that's the way I'm going to do it all the way through election eve.
Are we going to see a potential Tim Kaine for president campaign in 2020?
John, I tell you, I was really honored to be the first working Virginia politician on a national ticket since 1840 in 2016. But I definitely came back from that campaign saying, like at the end of The Wizard of Oz, there's no place like home. There's no place like home. I love the work that I'm doing in the Senate. And I love being able to live in Richmond and do work that matters, but just live like a regular person in a regular neighborhood with people who don't think of me as an elected official, but just think of me as their neighbor. So I am very focused on, if I'm elected, hopefully staying in the Senate for a good long while and continuing to serve Virginia in that way.
Okay, Senator Tim Kaine, I want to thank you for your time. We're out of time today. Great dialogue with you, sir. As always, it's always great to have you on. For more information on the senator's reelection campaign, go to timkaine.com. Timkaine.com. He's up for reelection on November 6th. That's the midterm. Circle it on your calendar. If you're in Virginia, listen to me right now. Early voting has started, so you can go and take care of that right now. Go to timkaine.com. Timkaine.com for more information. Kaine 2018. And by the way, that's Kaine with an E. Senator, thanks for being with us.